Hello, everybody. It's Gary Stuckey with Real Music. Hope you're doing okay today. I know I am. Feeling pretty good today. I've been chatting with a guy you might know. Oh, what's his name? Oh, yeah. Pat Boone. He is here talking about his new music. He's working on a new album. It's coming out soon. First time you'll hear about it right here on this show, a comedy album. He's covered everything, so might as well do the comedy thing. Of course, we talk about it all. He was friends with Elvis. We cover that. He was the second biggest charting artist of the late 50s, you know, right behind Elvis. Those two were friends throughout their careers and lives. And he holds a record for spending 220 consecutive weeks on the charts with one or more song each week. That is crazy. He's had over 2,600 singles. That's a record. I mean, so many things to talk about, so little time. I mean, he's covered everything. We talked about movies. We talked about, Ozzy Osbourne and Metallica. Just saying. Yeah, we talk about a little bit of everything, and I know that you're going to enjoy this interview. So here we go. Here he is. Here's Pat Boone.
You know what? I was thinking about this. I was looking at some pictures, and which my dad is a big fan of yours. He can tell you everything about you. He grew up listening to you. So he was singing some of your songs this morning. I told him I was going to talk to you, and it's just been crazy just
like
to see
him
and
already.
Talk to you.
I like
but he's
him.
A big he's a nice guy, but he really has he's a really big fan, and we'll talk about some of that. But what about those white shoes? Do you still have those white shoes that
I've
you always
a
wear?
A garage full of them. Bass Shoe Company in Maine created Bass Weegians and other kinds of shoes that people love. And when I, just out of my own teens, was wearing the only decent pair of shoes I had, which were white Bucks and I had that little bag that you could, you could flick powder on them and try to brighten them up when they got scuffed or dirty.
Right.
And when I went on TV, it was not a conscious intent, to create some kind of an image. Those were the only decent shoes I had. I was in college at North Texas State, and high school and college kids all over America were wearing white Bucks. But I was the first guy to wear them on national television. And as I was having hit records, and that became part of my image instantly, not purposely. But when I started to make some money from Sailor Records and buy some different clothes and get some black shoes, brown shoes, try to wear them on stage or even in person. And I could see the kids were looking at my feet and they were very disappointed. They had instantly become part of my persona. And so the Bass Shoe Company eventually created Pat Boone white Bucks. And I've got size 11 or 11 and a half white Bucks in my garage, boxes of them still with my name embroidered on the tongue. So these are Pat Boone white Bucks. And I've given them to many charities.
Awesome.
And they auction them off in charities, raise money, and people buy a pair of my white. What they do with them, I don't know. But it's up to them. I've had a couple of people say they make a nice planter. You can plant this, you can plant flowers in my shoes.
I guess so. I would not do that. I mean, I'm saying if you sent me some shoes, I would not use them as planters. I'm just saying.
But they've raised a lot of money for good cause.
And
I'm proud of that.
That's good. That's awesome. That's really awesome. Let's go back to the past. A blast to the past. Now, here's something my dad said. He was a fan of yours over Elvis, and I find that a lot of the kids, the teenagers back in the day, when they were polled, they chose you over Elvis. Now, tell me this. Of course, Elvis was popular too. What do you think it was about you that they liked more than Elvis?
Well, I was one of them. Elvis was definitely not one of them. He was something absolutely unprecedented as a performer. And yet I was barely out of my own teens when my career began, and my first record, I was 21 years old. And when I met Elvis, and he was my opening act in Cleveland, and a sock hop, he only had one record. It was a bluegrass country song by, you know, Bill Monroe, Blue Moon of Kentucky, Keep on Shining. Well, that was not rock and roll. It's bluegrass, and he was trying to make it, and his arrangement of it with his musician, trying to make it sound R&B, but it was definitely not R&B. So when he sang that song on that Cleveland sock hop the first night we met, I had 3 million selling hits at that moment. And he was just a newcomer. Nobody knew who he was. So he came out there and he lip synced with his two musicians, and they instrument, you know, they just played the instruments, but they were playing the record. That's what the kids were hearing. As when I came on, I just lip synced my record. And the kids didn't know who he was, but they liked the way he looked. And they didn't care for that bluegrass song. But then when he finished that, they gave him a nice big hand. They weren't screaming. They were just applauding this kid from Shreveport, Louisiana, they thought. And he said, thank you very much. I'd like to do the other side of that record for you. Hope you like it. And that was, that's all right, mama. That's all right with me. And that was a rhythm and blues song that he had recorded as the B-side of that first record. And it's a good thing he lip-synced that, because they loved it. And so did I. I was standing backstage. I said, oh, RCA Victor has signed him, but he hasn't recorded anything for them yet. But I could tell that in the way he was singing that song, that I was going to have to contend with him. And yet he was very bashful around me, because even though I was from Tennessee, Nashville, he from Memphis, we were almost the same age. I was 6 months older. But he told me later, after we got to know each other better and were visiting back and forth in homes in Bel Air and making movies in adjacent studios at 20th Century Fox, he says, I didn't know how to talk to you. He says, I said, why? He said, well, you were a star. I said, I was a star. I'd only been recording since March. And this was October of 55. He said, yeah, well, you were on the charts. I didn't know how to talk to you. And that just was evidence of how socially uncomfortable he was and remained. He was never, you kept his buddies around him all times. He's on stage. That was his element. He was very much at home on stage because he could control that. But when he was with people he didn't know and people who already had some success or something, he was almost tongue-tied. He'd not developed what I guess we would call social graces growing up as he did in Tupelo. And then in Memphis, he wanted his boys around him. He needed that sense of support and familiarity. And so even with me, when we met, we became instant friends, and we stayed that way for his whole life from then on. But
awesome.
But he was always shy in person.
Wow. Well, you know, a lot of people would think, you know, since you were competing on the charts, that there would be this rivalry. But as you said, y'all were friends. But that was cool to have you two guys having all the hits, being the biggest stars of the late 50s. I mean, and just amazing time for both of you, right? I mean, that's just something I think.
Well, there's a statistic that hardly anybody knows, but it was known then. At looking back, as the 50s ended, I had 41 chart records in the 50s, and he had 40. But you remember, wow. I had a six-month head start, and we knocked each other out of the number one spot on the record charts time after time. He'd be number one week, and the next week my record might become number one, and then a few weeks later he was number one again, and then I'd be number one after that. So we were really friendly competitors, but we were competitors. And in 1957, which was my biggest year, when I had some movies and I had 3 million sellers in the same year, and that I was doing the Pat Boone Chevy show on TV, the international polls about favorite male singing star, I was number one and Elvis was number two. But that was 1957. From 58 on, it was reversed. He was number one and I was number two. But that was fine for both of us.
Yeah, and that's awesome. Which also, you had a Billboard record for a long time for 220 consecutive weeks on the charts. That's crazy.
That is unbroken. Nobody has ever been on the Billboard show. The closest anybody has come that we can find is Elton John, who was on the Billboard single charts for 157 weeks. But I was on for 4.5 years.
Wow.
And without ever being off the single chart. Every time I opened a Billboard or Cashbox magazine, I could find which ones of my records were going up and going down. And then that time came when I couldn't find any of my records after 4.5 years. I had culture shock. I thought, what? Where's my record on the chart? Well, after 4.5 years, and then, of course, now after all these years, after 70 years of recording more single songs than any other artist in history, Frank Sinatra, some 1,500 songs. Bing Crosby was my early role model, and he's recorded 2,000 songs. But I've recorded 2,600 songs, 600 more than Crosby, and 1,000 more than Sinatra, because I kept recording all these years in many genres: country, gospel, pop, patriotic, rock and roll, heavy metal, and on. And I'm getting ready. I'm putting together a comedy album.
That's awesome.
It's going to be a compilation of all my voicemail messages over the years. That you know, because I get calls all the time from people I don't know. I don't know how they get my number. So I have I made up people and voice answers, from Forrest Gump to George Bush to Arnold Schwarzenegger. You ought to see Pat Boone. He's polishing his Volkswagen. He's popping out all over. And you never know who's going to answer my phone. And so I'm putting together a bunch of those, about 40 of them. And I'm going to see if I can get a comedy album nomination. But now I've got country, and I back on the country charts for the first time in many years.
Awesome. That's so awesome. Yeah, that's a lot of songs. That means you've been busy. You know what I was thinking about too? I was reading, you know, some of your biography and things like that. But you were like in your early 20s, and you had already had number one hits. You had your own show. You wrote a book that was the
bestseller.
Tell me, how did you do that?
Well, I tell you what, Gary. It's Gary, right?
Yes.
Gary.
Yes, Gary.
I don't know why. I suddenly, wait a minute, is this Gary I'm talking to? Yeah, of course it is. I tell you, it all happened to me. I didn't seek any of it. That's the God thing about it. Because when I made my first record, which was Two Hearts, Two Kisses, it was a cover of a song by The Charms on the Dutone label. One heart's not enough, baby. Two hearts will make you feel crazy. One kiss will make you feel so nice. Two kisses take you to paradise. Two hearts, two kisses make one love. Well, I think your dad loved that song. And that was
he sure did.
And it was my first record. I was a sophomore at North Texas State, married at 19, on my way to being a teacher, I thought. I'd given up the idea, even though I was from Nashville, of being a singer, because it was too complicated and I didn't have any real connections. But I'd won some talent contests nationally, and nothing came from it, it seemed, until about a year after, when Randy Wood of Dot Records outside Nashville, and of course I was a homeboy in Nashville, he called and said, "Well, you want to make a record? I saw you on these TV shows." And I said, "Well, sure, I'd love that." We were expecting our first baby already. And he said, "I'll send you a ticket, go to Chicago, and we'll make a record." Well, I did, and it was a million seller. And then soon after that, in May of that year, which was 55, we got to do a new record. So I recorded Fats Domino's Ain't That a Shame. His had been number one R&B, but that was a separate genre of music called race music or rhythm blues. And I recorded his song, Ain't That a Shame. Well, mine went to, he had sold 150,000 of his record, number one R&B, and that was big. I recorded that same song, my version of his song, and it sold 1.5 million just like that, after Two Hearts, Two Kisses. And he said many times, I made more money from Pat Boone's record of my song than from my own, because I was getting a royalty as a writer and publisher of the song. And Boone's record,
wow.
He didn't know it, but I was getting a 3% beginner royalty, and he was getting 6% from writing and publishing the song. He was making more money from my record of his song than I was. And,
wow.
And that was fine with me, and it was fine with him and Little Richard. When I recorded some Little Richard songs, the same thing, only Little Richard had been taken advantage of. He didn't know about writer royalty or producer royalty. And so that was kept from him. And so I recorded all the R&B songs, and then I was still in college. So now I had to go from North Texas, Denton, Texas, where Roy Orbison was coming up behind me in that same school. Went to New Jersey, and where our third and fourth babies were born. And so I was enrolled and graduating from Columbia University, magna cum laude, with honors. At the same time, I was doing the Pat Boone Chevy show on ABC television, youngest guy ever to have his own musical variety show, and all the big stars coming on my show and singing with me, having hit records, already making movies. In the summertime, we'd take a vacation from the TV show and I'd come to Hollywood and make a movie. And Elvis was making movies by then too, but I had the TV show, making movies, having hit records, and still making straight A's in college so I could graduate, so I could be a teacher. All of this at once. When I graduated in 58, at 23, we had four kids already, in addition to all that other stuff. So, I mean, I slept about 4 hours a night, and I lived on excitement. and pressure, because I had, you know, that was all those things at once, and I didn't seek any of them. They all just fell on me.
That has to show you that God was behind all of that. Couldn't have been anything else, right?
I knew that. So well, that's why, Gary, that throughout my whole career, I had the blessing of knowing that I had millions of kids at that time and following who were in some way or other being influenced by me. And then, of course, I had four kids of my own, but I knew I had to walk the straight and narrow. I had to live the life that I believed in. And that book you mentioned, that was a million seller book while I was still in college. And it was rivaled only in the sales charts by two books, Norman Vincent Peale's Power of Positive Thinking and Art Linkletter's Kids Say the Darndest Things. And then Pat Boone's Twixt 12 and 20 was a number one bestseller right between those two other two books while I'm still in college. So this was all happening in such a rush. Elvis had a rush too. He was having hit records, and he was traveling, and he had girls all over him, and he was making movies as well as records. But he wasn't in college, and he'd come over to our house. We had houses in Bel Air we were renting, and he'd come over on a Sunday afternoon, and we'd be in the pool, the kids and I and Shirley. And when he'd walk in the backyard, we didn't have a gate at that time. He'd just walk in. And the kids would jump up and run over on their daddy's friend, Elvis. And I'd say, girl, stop that. You're getting him all wet. He said, leave him alone, man. I like it. He did. He was there because he saw me with something he wanted. He wanted to have a wife. He wanted to have kids. But his Uncle Tom Parker, Colonel Tom Parker, didn't even want anybody to know who he was dating, much less get married and take him off the eligibility list. And so he couldn't even publicize Priscilla, who was already back at Graceland.
Wow.
So this was weird. We were happening at the very same time, and we were very friendly competitors, but living very different lives. And I wanted to share my kind of life with Elvis, and we did have conversations sometimes. And he told me he wished he could go to church like I did. And I said, "You can, why not?" Well, I disturb everything. I distract from the preacher and the kids be wanting my autograph. I said, "Don't you think it happens to me when I go to a church where I'm not a member? I just tell the kids, look, I'll sign your bulletins after church. Let me worship like you will. Let's just have worship together. And you know, they'll be looking at you, but you're used to that. Just worship the Lord when you were growing up. And then sign their bulletins. They'll take them to school and show them to their friends and say, where'd you get, was Elvis or Pat Boone at your church? Can we come?" And let it be an evangelical outreach. And he kind of grinned. He said, "No, I can't do it." But he says, "Do you know Oral Roberts?" I said, "Yes, I do." He said, "I'd like to talk to him sometime." I said, "Let me give you a clue. Your name is Elvis Presley. Get on the phone to Tulsa, Oklahoma. Have them put you, connect you to Oral Roberts University. Whoever answers, you just say, this is Elvis Presley. I'd like to talk to President Roberts." He'll be on in 15 seconds. He couldn't do it. He was socially, I don't want to say backward. He was just uncomfortable. So I called Oral Roberts. He flew out. He spent the afternoon with Elvis. Told me later, he's starved spiritually. He'd like to go to church like you do, but he doesn't think he can. So he stays at home, and his boys around him, they're interested in every other kind of spurious religion, not just Christianity, but Eastern religions and all kinds of, you know, brain power and all these other things that are intriguing. And Elvis would be intrigued with them too, because he was looking for spiritual stability, but he wasn't getting it anywhere. And we just didn't stay involved enough. I would love to have taken him to church with me, but I'm sure we would have disrupted if we'd both been in the same service together as we were the last time we met in the Memphis airport, where the last time we met, he was on his way back to the International Hotel. He was very downcast about it. He even looked like he wasn't feeling well, and he was heavy. And I was at the airport with my four daughters and Shirley. We had created a family act because I had to keep four teenage daughters in sight at all times. So we became the Pat Boone family. No other pop singer did that. But we were there at the airport. We have the picture. And he and Red West and Joey Esposito, Charlie Hodge there. And he was leaving from an adjacent gate before me. So I was just talking with him before he got on his plane. And he had a paunch, you know, right in front, and I patted him on his stomach. So, "What's this? You carrying your money in here?" And he said, "No, I've been eating too good, man, but where are you going?" And I said, "Orlando to a big Tupperware convention, a big convention." "Well, that's going the wrong way, man." And he turned to his buddies. He's always going the wrong way. And we were just kidding each other. And then I said, "Well, Elvis, it depends on where you're coming from." And that was the last conversation we had. A month later, he was gone.
Wow.
And I couldn't believe it, you know. And I have the picture in my office of that meeting at the Memphis airport. And when he said, "You're going the wrong way." And I said, "Well, it just depends on where you're coming from."
Wow. That has to stick out in your mind as you
it does. I just
think about it.
I hurt for him. I did then, and I do even more now, because I know that a lot of his things were most important to him were eluding him. His marriage was gone. He wasn't involved much with his daughter. He was with other women, but that they were not satisfying him in the way that a good marriage and a wife and family and kids like his own parents had and like he had when he was growing up. He didn't have any of that. And I made a statement when I had been with Priscilla and Lisa Marie about a month before she died recently. And I said, you know, looking at the life of Elvis, Priscilla, the Presley family, I made a statement, sometimes too little, too long is not as bad as too much, too soon. And I've never heard anybody say that, but he had so much and such a huge volume that it was impossible almost for anybody to handle it. The way I handled it was I had a wife, I had kids, I was involved in church spiritually. I started even then to read the Bible every year, as I have for about 47 years now. This is my 47th year, from beginning to end, all the way through. And I learn more every time. And that, and being in church and being involved with Christian events and Christian causes has kept my mind and my soul where I know God wants it to be. And he's helped me go through the minefield of the entertainment business, whether it's country, pop, rock and roll, or whatever, with a wife and kids, and got 16 grandkids now and 17 great grandkids. And this is what he wanted. When he would come into the backyard and my little kids would jump up on him, get him wet out of the pool, he was saying, I want a wife. I want kids. I want a family. And I better quit talking about it. I'll cry. Because he never had that.
He probably just saw himself through you, like how it could have been. And there's like two parallel guys, the careers going the same time, you know, what could have been. It's he would probably still be alive today. And
yeah,
if he had kind of followed that path.
I have often said if he took up golf and tennis instead of martial arts, which would have in necessitated social activity with other people outdoors, a lot of athletics, but not, there was a story he told me once, which I didn't believe, but he, you know, he was so into karate and the other martial arts. He said, it's really dangerous, man. He said, I was doing a movie on location and I came down this path between some trees. And this guy, just to have fun, jumped out from behind a tree, and I broke both his kneecaps before I knew what was happening. Because, you know, spontaneous kicks to the guy came out of the, I don't believe that. I think it would have been in the news. But he told him, he may have made jabs at the guy, but he told me that he broke both the guy's kneecaps before he, you know, like that, because he was so keyed up with the martial arts. But I had made a kind of a humorous remark that nobody could mess with Priscilla, because even though Elvis was gone a lot, that he had been instructed by a guy named Tony, it's the karate martial arts instructor. And I said, nobody can mess with Elvis or his wife, because Elvis, you know, knows martial arts. The only guy that could take his wife from him would be somebody that was younger, good looking, and maybe better at martial arts than he was. Well, that's what happened. Tony and he was there with Priscilla while Elvis was on the road. And eventually theirs became a relationship, and that's what ended their marriage. But I had been, you know, just a whimsical joke about nobody could rival Elvis with pretty Priscilla, except somebody that was better than Elvis in some other ways. Anyway, that's enough of that. I didn't know we were going to talk about Elvis.
but that's some interesting discussion there, but I'm sure everybody will get a kick out of that. Well, let's go back to you though, because I was telling about my dad earlier. You know what his favorite song is now? And I want you to sing some of it. I know you know it. Friendly Persuasion.
Oh, well, that's
his favorite.
The hardest songs that have had to record. The I love more than the meadows so green and still, more than the mulberries on the hill, more than the buds on the May apple tree. I love thee. It's not easy to sing. In fact, I had to bear up, you know, to do it just now. And I almost quit singing it in my personal appearances, because you sing a lot of other songs and then you come to that quiet, but rangy song. And I've learned how now to support it, as a singer has to do with his breath. To put on your bonnet, your cape, and your glove, and come with me. That's quite a jump. Anyway, that's for your dad.
Right.
But I love the song. And it was a Academy Award winner, and I got to sing it in the movie, Friendly Persuasion, with Gary Cooper, Dorothy McGuire, and the other magnificent cast, big, big film. But those things just fell on me. They opportunities just came to me. I didn't seek them. And I was happy to take advantage of every one. Actually, too many opportunities came, and my wife eventually said she felt she was married to triplets, and she wished two of them would go away. She just wants one of them. Now I've got a hit I hope your dad will like, called Grits. Because I've got three country hits on right now on the charts.
That's awesome.
The thing I did with Crystal Gayle, big hit of hers with Eddie Rabbit, we've redone it. It's on the country charts, just you and I.
Yes.
And a song that my buddy, my musical conductor, Dave Siebels, wrote with a buddy of his called My Stupid Tattoo. And that's on the country charts now, too. So three records on the country charts now at 89. As you know, they people are dubious about Biden. He's 81. I'm 89. I'll be 90 in June, and I'm still making hit records. And this book, are you familiar with this book of mine? It's the latest book. I've written other best-selling books, and it's called If. And that word I found is the most important word in the Bible. Every blessing of God comes with an if. And like the Garden of Eden, when he gave a perfect world to perfect people, Adam and Eve, he said, now just one thing, don't eat the fruit from that tree of the knowledge of good and evil. If you do, you'll die. They didn't know what death was. They didn't know what good or evil was. They were just innocent two young people. But he gave them one command. With the if you do, you die. Well, they did it. They died. Took them a long time.
Right.
And they had other kids. And they birthed the human race. But that if comes with every blessing of God. He wants to give us in every possible way that the Creator God can do. If we want it. If we will seek Him. If we will listen to what pleases our daddy. That's what He wants us to be, our daddy. And that's why I've written this book. It says here, not religious. It's just life or death.
And that's good. That's good.
My last very friendly, loving outreach to people who, according to Gallup and the other pollsters, say Barna, all of them, that over half of America now doesn't go to any place of worship. They don't may not pray. If they do, they don't know if anybody's hearing. If there is, they don't know if there's a heaven or a hell, if they're going to go there or not. I mean, we are woefully ignorant. We can no longer call ourselves one nation under God. We're a divided nation with less than half calling ourselves under God. So I'm trying to reach out to people in bus stops, airports, wherever they'll look over a selection of books so I get something to read on the plane or in my time, truck drivers. What's this? If what? Not life or death. It's life or death, not religious. Well, the eternal choice we all must make. What's that? Well, they open it up and they'll see some pictures and story about my career, so you know who's writing the book. But then lay it all out there in a very loving way, that the whole reason we exist as human beings is God wants a family. A family.
Awesome.
He wants to be our father. He wants kids that want to be like their daddy. That's what Christianity is about. It's about what human race is about. He didn't create us as robots. Of course, he gave us free will. So I try to make it, as I always did in my books that were bestsellers, very readable, understandable, not judgmental, not condemning, but reaching out to people, say, hey, you know, there's something really good that you're missing out on. And it can be an eternal existence which you're making the decision about now, whether you know it or not.
That's,
you're making the decision. Right. And then, of course, there's an album. Can I just show you this? Are you familiar with this, my album, which is a new miracle that just happened? It's the country.
Awesome. I've seen that. That's awesome. Yes.
You got it. And then, the design of it is incredible. Oops, I can't.
Wow.
The light's not helping me, but.
Yeah, I see it. I can see it.
Grits is in it. It's a very unusual, unique country album, because country artists don't generally record each other's songs. But I had been recording all along through my 70-year recording career, and all the albums and all the songs I've recorded were hundreds of country songs, big hits. And in this album, there are 26 million selling hits, which makes it unique. It's sung by one artist. And there's never been a country album like that. And of course, I throw Grits in there as a extra added attraction. But the song I do with the Crystal Gale, Just You and I, was a million seller with Eddie Rabbit. And now my version of it with her is in this album. So there's Hank Williams, there's George Jones, there's Eddie Arnold, there's all these great, great Tennessee Waltz. I'm from Tennessee. I was dancing with my darling to the Tennessee Waltz. And I think I've made a very good record of my hometown song, all in this one album. So at last, I think I'm being actually accepted and thought of, not just as a rock and roller or gospel singer or patriotic or hard rock, heavy metal or all those other things, but country. I'm a country guy. Right. I grew up in the country.
You're doing it all. That's awesome.
Yeah. And having fun.
Well, speaking, you're talking about the heavy metal. Now check this out. This is what I love about you, you know, through all your career. I remember at the award show that year where you come out and you had the vest and you just did the rock album, the heavy metal album. And at first I was like, oh boy, what is this? I listened to it and I was like, I like this album.
Yeah,
it's really
yeah.
good.
It's
it was good.
These were big band jazz orchestras. We added the heavy metal of trombones, trumpets, saxophones to the guitars and the drums. We had Sheila E. playing drums. We had Dweezil Zappa playing a Hendrix guitar on my version of Smoke on the Water. And and I did Guns N' Roses, Paradise City, Enter Sandman, Metallica, which is, when I talked to Hetfield and Ulrich and the guys from Metallica, I said, who was that little kid on your record of Enter Sandman? Oh, it's one of the roadies kids. We didn't have any kids. And it's that song, Enter Sandman, is a man putting his son to bed and scaring him in the time-honored way of saying, which is something on the ceiling, you better stay in bed, something under the bed, something's going to get you if you don't stay in bed. And then you hear the lead singer saying, now I lay me down to sleep. And you hear a little kid say, now I lay me down to sleep. I pray the Lord. That's in that record, on Metallica's record. And of course, my little four-year-old grandson is on my record of that. So
that's okay.
It was all good songs that was, I felt, covered up with all the cacophony and shouting and the screaming manner of rock and roll. When I did Paradise City, I was going to have Slash play guitar with me. He said he would on that record. But when I was recording it, they were trying to get Guns N' Roses back together again, and he couldn't take the time to work with me on my record. When he heard my record and he saw that I was doing it faster, which was a mistake for me. I mean, it's still all right, but I sang it faster than I needed to because it was so caught up in the excitement. He said, I can't play it that fast. I said, come on, you're Slash. You could play any tempo.
He's like fast.
but you know, I had other artists, real hard rock artists coming and say, hey, do some of our songs. We got some you can do like that with big band jazz arrangements. They love that treating their songs as real music Ozzy Osbourne moved in next door to me, you know, after I had recorded his song, Enter Sandman.
Right.
I mean,
Crazy Train.
Crazy Train, Crazy Train.
Yeah.
And yeah. I hadn't met him yet. He just moved in, and I go out to get the mail, and here he comes down the sidewalk. He had just moved in right next door, over the hedge from our house. And there's a Escalade Cadillac he's coming down to get into, and he's shuffling down the sidewalk. And I said, Hi, Ozzy, I'm Pat Boone. He said, oh, nice to meet you. He said, I'm on my way to an AA meeting, but when I get home, we'll get together and have some tea, okay? And we did.
We
got to be friends with him right next door for 3 years. And then they started his TV show. And to my amazement, when I tuned in, he'd moved away by then up into another part of LA. And I tuned in to see the show, and there was my version of his song as his theme song. Crazy, hey, that's how it goes. He and Sharon liked my version of the way I did his song. They made it their theme song. These things are just hard to believe, aren't they? I mean, the way
it's also. Oh yeah, and let me say this real quick to wrap it up and to kind of finish it up. But talking about my dad's favorite movie of yours is State Fair. And I love the musical too. So he loves State Fair.
I thought you were going to say it was Journey to the Center of the Earth, maybe.
That's my favorite movie of yours, which I love. So cool. Got the comic book to that
science,
too. But
science fiction, yeah. But Anne Margaret, so awesome. State Fair. Mm-hmm. And then in that musical, of course, I had the incredible honor that I didn't seek of Richard Rodgers writing me a new song, because that had already been on Broadway as a hit musical. It had been done as a movie musical before. And so he wanted something new, we did. And he wrote me a song called Willing and Eager, which I sing with Anne Margaret pawing my bare chest and a rather erotic scene in that movie. It was not involving sex, but it was sensual. And it was my first real movie kiss with Anne Margaret. And she sang a reprise of the song while she's playing tic-tac-toe on my bare chest with her fingernails. But the movie was a huge hit, and it saved, I'm confusing that with Journey to the Center of the Earth, which I didn't want to do. Is science fiction. I wanted to do movie musicals. And I got talked into it and given a piece of the film if I would do it. Well, I didn't expect to make anything from that. But it's just another story why I didn't want to do that film. But I did it anyway. And they told me later, the 20th Century Fox executives, that movie, The Journey to the Center of the Earth, saved 20th Century Fox from bankruptcy, because they were going under with the film Cleopatra, with Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton disappearing for a week at a time to pursue their romance, leaving 500 extras in costume in Rome, Italy, wondering, where are they? We can't shoot without them. And the bankers were getting fed up with it. And then my movie of Journey to the Center of the Earth came out, and it was such an instant hit that it saved 20th Century Fox. But again, these things I didn't know about. I didn't engineer them. They were just happening to me and around me. So that's the story of my career. It all just fell on me, but I know God had a purpose in it. And I've just tried to live in a way that would fulfill his purpose for me.
Well, I think you have done that. I mean, just watching your career, and you've always gave credit to God, and you've always accomplished. There's so many things to talk about. I mean, and one, maybe we can do another conversation one day, but there's so many things you have done that people don't know about.
Yeah.
And they need to find out, but it's just so amazing. I can't even believe I'm talking to you. It's just crazy, but God bless you and all you do, and more success. I'm hoping the comedy album takes off and these songs
that you've been doing. I heard that first. You're the first for me to ever talk publicly about it. That I am putting together about 40 of my favorite voice messages. I could I could keep you laughing for a while about the results of some of them, and the fact that my wife kept saying, "You can't put that on your phone, Pat. Stop that. Erase that." I was laughing too hard, and it was just a way of having fun. I needed my own outlets to have fun. If I was going to try to live the right kind of life, I at least deserved chances to have fun, which I certainly found. Well, look, I'll better quit and hop off.
Alrighty. Well, thank you. And remember this, my name is Gary Cooper Stuckey. So if you ever remember Gary Cooper from the Friendly Persuasion.
And you know what else I love is Stuckey's. Stuckey's establishments along the way, all the way from Nashville to Jacksonville. I always stopped in Stuckey's to get their peanut brittle and the nuts and the fudge. Stuckey's. So, okay, Gary Stuckey.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. I'm going to post this and everybody's going to love it. You're just amazing and always will be. And I thank you so much for doing this. I really do. I can't even say.
Do it. And yeah, maybe we could do an encore because I do have a few more stories.
That'll work. I'll be ready. Thank you so much.
Hey, thanks for tuning in, everybody, to another episode of Real Music. Pat Boone was here. Oh, man. Oh, man. So cool. I can't believe it. I still can't believe it. It's like a dream. Really love the guy. Very talented. What a career, you know, and still going. Looking forward to that comedy album. Check out his website and check him out on social media for more. And always remember to keep the music real.